Welcome to Between the Margins on CHRW Radio. I'm Michelle Boyce.
I'm Gio Lakey, back after a two-week hiatus.
Yeah, and we have Maha doing helping us out here again in the studio doing commentary. We have a special guest, and her name is Sue Kenny, and she's a pilgrim, and we'll talk about more of that in a minute. This is our Spiritual Journeys and Life-Altering Moments show. You know, for the last little while, we've been doing some heavier topics. We touched on accessibility and gender identity, and, we had
our lovely non-Christmas Christmas show.
The non-Christmas show, which was a big hit. So we're going to lighten it up a little bit now and you know, talk about more of the personal journey. And, you know, this is Between the Margins, a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. So this is more the happily ever after part of the show. So we're going to bring up Sue Kenny, who is joining us on the phones, and we're going to just play a little bit of an introduction clip, and then we're going to bring her up.
For over 1,000 years, pilgrims from all over the world have followed the road that leads to Santiago de Compostela, the city that grew up around the tomb of the Apostle St. James.
And Sue, welcome to the show.
So much. It's great to be on.
And you are a pilgrim.
I am. Yes, a pilgrim who's walked the Camino de Santiago de Compostela.
And that's in Spain, right?
Yes, it's a 1,200-year-old pilgrimage route in Spain. So if you can imagine, millions and millions of people have walked it, over hundreds of years. So it's quite special.
Yeah, you and I met each other where we were both helping out at the Human Resources Professional Show, and I listened to your story, and I was absolutely awed by it.
Oh, thank you.
So before we talk about the Camino, because that's way into your story.
Yes.
Yeah, so you want to just, you know, bring us up to date on what took you to Spain and the Camino?
Okay, well, actually, I heard about the Camino, just to give you an idea of how I heard about it. I was channel hopping, watching TV, like different programs, and I came across a special on walking tours in Spain that the Lonely Planet did. And I saw the Camino and thought, wow, isn't that interesting? You know, I'd love to do that one day, but I don't have a month in my life to, you know, to take out and just go for a walk. Because at that time in my life, I was a single mom with 3 teenage daughters living in Toronto. I was training as a competitive rower in the masters category. So basically, masters rowing is anyone over the age of 27. Okay. And I was training like 5, sometimes 6 times a week. And also, I was working full-time as an account executive at a telecommunications company, and I was actually part of a team of people who were pulling together the BlackBerry application. So I had the first BlackBerry, and I was the person who was responsible for the voicemail application and integrating that. So I had, as you can tell, a very, very busy life. And I did everything fast. And then one day I went into work and I had a meeting with my boss. So I went into the meeting room and I noticed the door was closed, which was kind of odd. But I opened the door and there was a woman sitting across the table and I recognized her as someone from Human Resources. And I thought, uh-oh, this can't be good. And sure enough, my boss was there and he said, Sue, please sit down. We have something to tell you. And, of course, they informed me that my job had become redundant due to restructuring of the organization, and they no longer required my services. So they gave me a package and walked me to my desk, handed me a cardboard box, suggested I take my personal belongings because I wouldn't be returning to the building, and then they escorted me out the door for the very last time. And you can imagine, the emotions and the frustration and the humility I felt as well. And I got in my car and started to drive home and questioned a lot of things in my life. I began to, you know, wonder if all this work I had done to achieve, you know, the American dream and, you know, have a great job with a successful career and a wonderful family and a dog and a cottage and a house. I began to question, like, what is it all about? And so I decided that day when I got home that maybe I needed to go for a very, very long walk to try and, you know, figure out what was important in life. And so I had seen the show about the Camino, and it's 780 kilometers. And so 5 weeks later, I left and embarked on this incredible life-altering journey.
And you really didn't prepare well for that, as I recall.
Well, I thought because I was a rower, and rowers are very, very strong and fit individuals, right? I thought, oh, well, I'm a rower. I'm strong. I can do this. So I left 5 weeks later. But what I didn't realize is that, you know, rowing and walking are very different sports or activities. And also, I wasn't accustomed to walking with a backpack, and I had way too much weight in my backpack. I was carrying 25 pounds of stuff. And I had read on the internet that, you know, the average weight for a person, you know, is 25 pounds. So I thought, oh, I'm well within that range. But what I didn't realize is that's the average weight that a 6-foot-tall male carries on the Camino.
Well, you know, you didn't need those 10 pairs of shoes.
Yeah, right. No, I only had my boots, my hiking boots, and then one extra pair of shoes that I changed into at night.
Cool. So you jumped on a plane
yeah.
with your 25-pound pack
yes.
and dropped yourself. Now, did you start in France or did you start in Spain?
Well, actually, I started in France because the Camino, the route that I walked on the Camino is called the Camino Francés, which means that the people from France and even from Germany and further on in Europe, they would walk from all over Europe, meet on the path, and then join up right at the border between France and Spain in the Pyrenees Mountains. There's a small village called Saint-Jean-Pied-de-Port, and many of the pilgrims, modern-day pilgrims today, will start there because that's where, you know, it's a great starting point. And also, the very first day, if you start in France, the very first day you walk over the Pyrenees Mountains, and you climb like 5,000 feet and walk, you know, 26 kilometers. I mean, it's insane. It's so difficult. But it's also exhilarating and gets you, you know, onto the path very quickly.
Wow. So that must have been quite, what kind of emotions were running through your mind? You know, you're alone, you're in France, and, you know, you've been through a lot over the last 5 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I can't even imagine what must have been going through your head.
Well, I guess the biggest thing was fear. And many people ask me to this day, weren't you afraid? And I always say, of course, I was afraid, but it didn't stop me. But I remember being afraid of the wild dogs that I'd read about in Shirley MacLaine's book about the Camino. And I was afraid of, I have a fear of heights, and so I was afraid of falling off the mountain and nobody finding me. And I was afraid of getting lost, and I was afraid of being robbed or, you know, being attacked in some way. And I had, like, many fears. And also, I couldn't speak Spanish at all. So, and my French, you know, I went to school back in the days when there was grade 13. So I did have grade 13 French, but let me tell you, I've forgotten a lot of it, and I was, like, making up words and speaking, like, Franglish Spanish and, you know, putting words together and using my hands and laughing and just to try and communicate with people. But that definitely was one of the fears.
Okay. Well, we've got a clip here that's going to just introduce the Camino to the audience. If you can just hold on there, and we'll be back in 2 minutes with Sue.
For over 1,000 years, pilgrims from all over the world have followed the road that leads to Santiago de Compostela, the city that grew up around the tomb of the Apostle St. James. Since its beginnings, the Camino de Santiago was not just a road for religious pilgrimage. As a meeting place for people from different backgrounds, it gave rise to a culture based on the exchange of ideas and artistic and social currents. Today, in the 21st century, Santiago continues to be visited via a variety of routes by pilgrims from every continent and every social background. The French Way, traditionally the best known, reaches Spain across the Pyrenees. Although the Portuguese or the Northern Way, skirting the Bay of Biscay coastline, also lead to Compostela. One of the Camino's permanent features is its hospitality. Nowadays, there exists a large network of hostels scattered all along St. James Route, opening their doors for pilgrims. Compostela is the goal for walkers and travelers, and at the same time is the starting point for a new journey when you reach the Plaza de Obradoiro. Proudly seal their Compostela, which demonstrates that they have completed the Camino, and later explore the Forest of Stone, every day by the thousands of pilgrims and tourists who visit.
Welcome back. And I just wanted to introduce Maha, who is sitting here, and she's been through a journey of her own. And she was born in Saudi Arabia and came to this country looking for the good life. And then was here through 9/11 and all of the issues that people have had with the Muslim population, and then was diagnosed at a very young age with breast cancer, mm-hmm. and has spent the last, 5 years?
3 years.
3 years?
Yeah, and counting.
And counting, recovering from that. And that was a major life-altering moment for you.
Oh, of course. It still is every day. I mean, every day I try to reconnect with missing parts of myself. And just like Sue, I mean, I look at Sue and I look at her journey, and she went on this, like, as she said, she went on this really long walk. With me, I tried to find other ways, not so much. I didn't put as much physical exertion on myself, but it was more of a mental process, as I'm sure she went through a mental process walking that path alone. I used other outlets. I used writing and comedy and a lot of creative outlets just to kind of help me through and to try to reconnect with whoever I was, because I also found myself asking that question, you know, who am I and what am I made of and what's there left of me that I remember and that I know is true. And every day I'm learning something new and I'm connecting with other people, and it's really scary. So actually, I had a question for Sue, if you don't mind me asking.
Sure.
But I mean, I always hear that your biggest enemy is yourself. And going through my journey, I found that I was really scared at the beginning to kind of look into myself and overanalyze myself and kind of deconstruct myself. And I was just wondering, what was your biggest fear, knowing that you were going to be breaking yourself down? What were you afraid of finding?
That's an excellent question. In fact, my deepest fear was facing the truth about myself.
Mm-hmm.
I was afraid of seeing something, because I realized that if I saw what my true purpose in life was, then I would be absolutely 100% obligated and committed to doing that. And I didn't know what it would entail. I didn't know if it would mean, you know, either going to a third world company and working as a working as a missionary, or would it be, you know, something else? I had no idea. But what I found on the Camino was the process of walking forward gave me this feeling, this very strong feeling, that as I took each step forward, I was walking back to myself. And in the process of walking back to myself, It was a slow process, and it was an easing into an understanding of who I am. But also, I came to the absolute realization and confirmation that everything that I need is within me, and that it's okay, and it's all right to look at myself and look at the truth and accept it for what it is, that nothing is right or wrong, good or bad, it just is.
So did you find that a liberating process to kind of really break yourself down and find out everything about yourself? Did you find it liberating, or did you find it kind of restricting because it made you have to face everything that you are?
Oh, in the end, it was liberating. And through the process of it, it was frightening. And there were times where I wanted to, you know, just go back home, or, you know, I'd be standing on the path and I'd, you know, look around. I didn't know where I was. I didn't know where I was going. I hadn't seen anyone for hours. I was alone. I was cold. And I'd, you know, say to myself, geez, you know, I could be on a cruise finding myself. What am I doing out here? But then, you know, it wouldn't be like me to go on a cruise to find myself. And then, I'd take another step, and I'd take another step. And before I knew it, I just put one foot in front of the other. And that process was very liberating and freeing.
Now, when you were at the Camino, you didn't pick the best time of year to do this.
No. But I really believe that I didn't choose when I went on the Camino, that there was, you know, there was something else in play, absolutely no question. And just the fact that I was downsized in October, I knew that if I didn't walk the Camino right away, that I might not do it. So I just booked the next plane ticket I could get, basically, and left 5 weeks later.
How did you find when you came back home? How were your thoughts different? I mean, I'm sure you said you went through this really, like, you rebuilt yourself and you reconnected with yourself in a whole different light. So when you came back home and you were surrounded by, I don't want to say reality, but you were surrounded by everything again and nothing around you has changed. It's just you that's changed. Did you find that difficult to kind of reconnect with your family and with your friends and just the world in general?
Absolutely. When I was on the Camino, the pilgrims refer to their life back home as the other world.
Yeah.
And it is a completely different place. Mm-hmm. And my children, you know, they were 14, 17, and 19 at the time. And when I came home, they were afraid that I had changed and that they wouldn't know me, or they wouldn't, you know, that I just changed, and they would be uncomfortable with that. And the thing that I kept saying to them was, I haven't changed. I've just become more of myself. And that's not different. It's just, it's better. And the process of facing the world back home was very difficult because everything looked different. I couldn't understand why people were rushing around, why people were not present and not aware, and why they didn't see the value in you know, in just stopping and talking to a stranger or you know, giving money to someone begging on the street. I don't know. It just seemed more, it seemed so much more natural for me to be present and aware. And one of the things that I had to keep reminding myself was that the Camino was within me. It was a part of me. Probably like your journey, Maha, you didn't change as a person.
No.
Some things about you changed, you know, physically maybe, and your, you know, your perspective. But in the end, the Camino is with me all the time.
Exactly, and that's what I felt like. You can take all these long walks and you can go on all these journeys, but at the end you always end up running into yourself again.
Yeah.
But it's different. Every time you look back, it's almost like you find another piece of yourself.
Yeah.
I've honestly started to believe that I existed on this planet long, long time ago, and now I'm just finding pieces of myself and putting it together again. And I find that extremely lonely because I like you said, you look around you and you wonder why nobody's kind of stopping to pick up their own pieces slowly and, you know, really think it through. And I find that difficult. I find that extremely difficult. So I have to let you know, you've become my inspiration.
Oh, thank you.
I'm extremely inspired by you, and I think everyone should do what you've done. I mean, if they can. A lot of us aren't rowers.
Yeah.
not exactly up to it physically, but I honestly think it's truly inspiring, and thank you so much for giving me a lot to think about as well.
Well, you're welcome. And the other thing that I just want to comment on is that at first I came home and I judged people and said, why are they doing this? Why don't they get it? Don't they realize how important, you know, life is and this moment and people. And then as I integrated my journey back home, I shifted. And the shift that I took, that took place in me was that I stopped judging people for what they were doing. And I came to the very clear understanding that they are on their life journey.
Mm-hmm.
And that at this point in their life, they're rushing, maybe. But so did I. And so who am I to judge what they're doing or where they are on their path? And instead, I decided that I wanted to use my voice to share the stories of the Camino without judgment to inspire others as they walk on their life journey. And that had a profound effect on me, because instead of trying to save the world, which is what I wanted to do, now I'm being a part of, you know, of the world and contributing in a great way.
And you truly are.
Well, thank you.
Certainly. And I have a question for you, Sue.
Sure.
As you're speaking about how nice it would be for everybody to have this opportunity, and I know that from reading on your website that you've actually made a couple of trips back, but for those of us who are sitting here going, well, I do an hour on the treadmill once a night, that's a long enough walk for me, what was life like on the El Camino? What were the conditions actually like?
Well, in fact, you walk through all different terrains, like everything from like mountains, full mountains, to forests and hills, and you walk across streams and through streams sometimes, and on little footpaths and beside a highway, and then there's a section on the Camino that's 200 kilometers long. It's called the Meseta. And they say on the Meseta you can lose your mind, and I can vouch for that because it is almost 200 kilometers of completely flat land.
Wow.
So it's kind of like walking through Saskatchewan.
I was just thinking that myself.
Okay, there's wheat fields after wheat fields after wheat fields. But this section, lots of people will get on a train or a bus and bus through it because it's not interesting and they don't want to do it. But in fact, I knew intuitively deep inside that this was a very important part of the journey, because the journey can't always be fun and exciting and interesting and beautiful. But in fact, you know, I knew that I had to take this walk through the Meseta in order to come out at the other end and experience something. So, you know, so it's important to know that it's not a walk in the park, and yet it's, you're spending all of your day with Mother Nature.
Well, I can certainly imagine that such a long stretch would give you quite the opportunity for self-reflection as well.
And especially in Spain, it rains a lot. So I walk through snow, rain, hail, winds, really powerful winds up in the mountains, sun, fog, absolutely every kind of weather you could imagine I ended up walking through because of the time of year I walked.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up, and because I walked right across the north of Spain, I ended up just walking through all different terrains and all different weather conditions as well.
Wonderful. Well, we're going to have to take a slight break here for commercials and station IDs, etc. We will be back in about 2 minutes.
We are all in this together, brothers and sisters.
Welcome back to Between the Margins on CHRW Radio. I'm Michelle Boyce.
And I'm Gio Lakey.
And I'm Maha.
And we have Sue Kenny on the phone with us talking about the Camino de Santiago. Did I get that right?
Yes, the Camino de Santiago de Compostela.
Yeah, you know how many times I've been saying that and for the last week, and every once in a while I blow it completely.
You can just call it the Camino.
We'll do that. So, you know, in my own story, and what brought me to, well, a radio host on CHRW Radio, came back from, you know, back when I was 17 years old, I had a major car accident. And my best friend was, you know, helping his mom move her sister to Toronto, and I jumped in the van to give a hand. And you know, on the way back, everything went fine up until, you know, she was driving and she ran at the back end of a stop transport truck at 100 kilometers an hour. And I was the only survivor of that accident.
Oh.
And when we talk about life-changing moments, you know, you had, you know, a walk, and Maha's had her journey, and I had 14 months lying in a hospital bed staring at a ceiling. And, you know, it really makes you think about the important things in life. And, you know, when I'm going through life and somebody starts annoying me or somebody starts bothering me, you know, I just look at it and say, you know, if I was lying on my deathbed right now, would this actually matter?
Mm-hmm.
If you had any similar experiences with, you know, all of a sudden taking people easier?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I haven't had, you know, sort of up until this point in my life anyway, something happened to me like that. And people will often say to me, you know, why would you choose to go into a state where you, you know, you'll be walking for 20 to 40 kilometers an hour, a day, and, you know, it's uncomfortable, it hurts, you have pains, I had injuries, I had, and why would somebody choose to do that? And, you know, maybe part of me, you know, wanted to go and experience pushing myself beyond a place that I thought I could. But what I found when I came back home again was I come back to this point that I made earlier, and that is that, you know, who am I to judge other people on their journey? I've experienced something myself which was important to me, but I'm not suggesting everybody walk the Camino. Lots of us can't, lots of us don't want to, and lots of us never will. But what I'm suggesting is to be on a life journey. As, you know, as you said, Michelle, be present. I mean, you know, life is short. You've experienced that. You understand it. But, you know, be on that journey. Be present. Be aware. Be there for other people, for, you know, for humankind. That has become more and more important to me. Not as much, you know, it's not as much about making money or, you know, setting a career that's going to give me a big payback or, you know, investing in the real estate market so I can make money. Those things aren't as important for me now, although I am at a different time in my life than, you know, maybe the students would be. But still, they're not that important to me. What's most important is to use my experience and use my gifts and tell the stories. And Maha, you mentioned about, you know, using the creative outlets like writing and comedy. And I just so respect that and admire that in
you.
Because that, I think that's what we need, is we need to be more creative. And even my philosophy now, of having walked, I understand now that there's a correlation between walking and creativity. I even found out that Beethoven was once commissioned to do some work, to write some music, and he didn't get paid to write the music. Instead, three Austrian businessmen paid him to walk every day from sunrise to noon, because they knew if he walked every day, he would create a masterpiece.
Wow. I believe that.
And that's the truth. And so, you know, that's why I'm encouraging people to walk, you know, whether it's, you know, around the block or on your treadmill or whatever. But if we become more creative, then we will come up with creative solutions for homelessness or for poverty or hunger or world peace. But that's where I think I can contribute.
Yeah. You have a fascinating, I don't know what to call it, a revelation or an experience that, you know, really hit me when you were talking about it, and that's the stone by stone piece. Can you talk about that?
Sure, I can. Well, when I set out on the Camino, as I said, I was afraid. I was scared. And I knew that in order for me to figure out what was important in life, what my purpose was, I knew that I had to first get a clear understanding of myself, and I had to love myself first, because I really believe that everything comes from a place of love. And so in order to love others or to really experience this, I had to love myself, but I didn't know how to do that. And so I started to walk the Camino, and every day I would, you know, I'd walk and I noticed there'd be stones along the side of the path, and I wondered why they were there. So I would often pick up a stone and add them to the pile. And then one evening I was at dinner with a group of pilgrims, and I asked the group, I said, does anybody here know why there are piles of stones all along the way? And this pilgrim sitting across the table from me became really excited and said, "Hey, I know a story about stones." And I said, "Okay, please share your story." And he said, "It is said if you pick up a stone and you put your sorrow into the stone, when you place the stone down, you leave some of your sorrow behind." Well, I was really moved by this because I thought, if I could put my sorrow down on the Camino, then maybe that would open up my heart for more love. If I could open up my heart for more love, then I could learn to love myself, and from that place I could truly understand what my gifts are, what I can contribute, what am I here for, what am I supposed to be doing, what I'm supposed to be doing. So the next morning I got up, got ready, I was out the door, first pilgrim out of the hostel, and I looked around for a stone right away, and I found one. I picked it up, and then I realized that he didn't tell me how to put sorrow into the stone. So I thought, well, I'll just imagine that I'm doing it. So I walked along, and I rubbed the stone, imagining I was putting my sorrow into it. Well, after a little while, I decided it was time to put the stone down. When I set it down on top of some other stones, right away, something shifted. Like something moved from me, and I felt so good that I wanted to pick up another stone right away. So this time I thought, well, maybe I'll pick up a stone for my children, because I was missing them so much on the Camino, and I didn't have a cell phone or anything with me, and it was very difficult to reach them. Every time I called home, it seemed like they weren't there. I had to leave a voicemail. So I thought of my oldest daughter, Tara, and I picked up a stone for her, and I imagined her sorrow and set it on the Camino. I did the same thing for my middle daughter, Megan, and then I picked up a stone for my youngest daughter, Simone. Well, before I knew it, I realized that not only could I put my sorrow into a stone, but I could put the sorrow of others. It was like my gift that I could give them from the Camino. So every day I started this ritual. The first stone was for me. The next three stones were for my daughters. And then after that, I would pick up stones for my mom and my dad and my sisters and my brother and my friends. Anybody who came into my mind, I would pick up a stone for them and leave their sorrow on the Camino. Now, what's important to know is that I didn't know what their sorrow was necessarily. I just knew that we all carry some level of sorrow. And so I did this every single day. And then I got really close to the end of the journey. It took me 29 days to walk 780 kilometers.
Oh, my God.
And near the end, I ran into this pilgrim, Andreas, again. And I hadn't seen him the whole way. And he was the one that told me the story of the stones. And I said to him, "Oh, my gosh, your story has changed my life. I've, you know, put all my sorrow on the Camino." And I felt completely liberated in this incredible state of grace. And he looked at me and he said, "Well, didn't I tell you? I don't actually believe in sorrow stones." And I said, "Well, what do you mean you don't believe in them? Are you telling me this isn't true? Are you telling me that, you know, that I've left all this sorrow on the Camino and it's not going to work?" And he looked at me and he said, "No." He said, "What I'm telling you is that it's just a story. Somebody told it to me and I was sharing it with you." And it was at that moment that I realized that it wasn't about what anybody else thought or believed. It was about what I believed. And because I believed I could put sorrow into a stone, I can. And that story changed my life.
That's such a touching story that, you know, it still gives me chills every time I hear it. And I know I talked to people after your presentation, and that was the piece that it really seemed like that was a gift to the world from you to them.
I feel like it's a gift to the world. I feel that if I keep that story for myself, then I am doing a disservice to the universe. And for any, you know, writers that are listening, I know when I didn't want to write a book about the Camino, it was people who heard my story. They said to me, "You should write a book." And I said, "Well, no, I'm not a writer." And they said, "Well, no, you should write a book." And so many people suggested I should write a book. But I kept, you know, judging my story and thinking, well, who's going to want to hear my story? You know, everybody's got their own story. What's the big deal about mine? And then one morning I woke up and I realized that it wasn't about me. It wasn't about whether I thought I was a writer or not. It was about the idea that these stories are a gift and that I should share them. And that's what I'm doing.
Wonderful. And you are doing it extremely well, in my opinion. I know myself and my journey, and I mean, like you, I was part of the corporate rat race, and I was the boss. And I had, back in 1999, I had 9 businesses running and, you know, millions of dollars trading hands. And I looked at my daughter, who's a newborn at that point in time, and my son, I had always brought him to the stores, and I'd brought him to my businesses, and I had a nursery there. And I had 2, and all of a sudden, my life didn't fit anymore. And, well, I had a complete breakdown, and I walked away from it all. And, you know, June 30th, 1999, I turned locks in all of my businesses and walked away. And, you know, that was when I started realizing that power of positive energy and how you are what you eat, so to speak, and you are what you think. And, you know, if you live your life with a moral compass that, you know, always points north, then you can have an effect on other people. And, you know, other people may not share your belief system, but you can actually, you know, affect the little decisions in their lives and such and give them something to pull strength from. And I think that's what your story does for people. I think your story gives people hope that regardless of what's going on in their life, that they too can be good people and they too have a hope.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, in the end, after I had walked the entire journey, I realized that what I came to understand was this idea that there is hope, that hope itself exists. And I, before I left on the Camino, I had sort of given up on, I don't know, on the world, on society, on, I don't know, I'd given up on a lot of things because I, you know, because I'd committed and dedicated, and I was a loyal employee, and I worked hard, and then I just got, you know, shafted in a way. But in the end, it was the greatest gift I could have received. So it's, you know, it's part of the journey, but it is about having hope. As long as we have hope, I mean, look at the people in Haiti. I mean, They are clinging on to hope. They have to be, because they don't have very much else to cling on to. And we are so fortunate here in this world that we live in that that I think it's important to share it.
I have to absolutely agree with you. When you said that it not only does it liberate you, but it gives you a form of control over your identity and over everything that you are. And I think anything hard, any hardship that comes towards you, it really does. If you use it, if you utilize it in a positive way, it does give you a sense of control over yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe, like what you said in your writing, it's such a selfless act, because you're putting every piece of yourself out to people. You're exposing yourself and you're projecting yourself onto others. And you're right, because at the end of the day, it becomes about the people around you and how they are influenced by your words, and they're influenced by your story. And I found the same kind of idea with my writing. Instead of, you know, sitting in the corner and crying, which I did anyway,
yeah.
I would get up. I gave myself 10 minutes a day I could cry, and then I would get up and I started writing, just writing about my experiences. And it was so open, and I felt almost naked writing them.
Yeah.
And I was shocked at the amount of people who came up to me after and told me their own stories of someone they knew who was touched by cancer. And people came up to me telling me how they completely changed their lives. At that point in time, 90% of my friends were bankers. And it was, a lot of them left their jobs.
Yeah.
Because they felt like they could do a lot more, and they could do something different, and they can be whoever they want to be based on what I was writing. And it helped me, because then I started to look at myself and say, well, you know what? Yeah, I'm actually pretty awesome. So, I mean, it is a selfless act, but it does, at the end of the day, not only does it connect you with yourself and it gives you a sense of control, but it reaches out to a lot, to everybody around you, and even nature. You reach out to nature and you become one with everything. And I think that's exactly the same feeling that Michelle has with sharing her story as well.
Absolutely. And we're going to take a short break here. We're going to hear a clip about a couple other people's experiences on the Camino, and we will be right back.
And it seems that there are three different parts in the Camino. The first one, we could say that is the physical part, because we are mainly aware of our body because of the pains and aches and problems we can have. We are really in touch with our body, with our sensations. And then after some days walking, that our body is getting stronger and stronger because of the exercise, we don't think about that anymore. It's something that is just happening, walking. And it seems that this part is the time we walk through the flat land here in Spain, in El Camino. And it seems that it's a difficult part because it's just flat and you can get bored. So many emotions arise because of that, because of the boredom. And then reaching already Galicia, the last part, we overcome both physical and emotional, and then we are more in the spiritual side of us.
I was reaching a stage where I was very much enjoying my daily walk, and it had become like a meditation. I've now been walking for about 32 days. When I first started, I needed to use sunscreen and wear a hat. Now it's like I'm part of nature. I enjoy the sun on my face. I enjoy listening to the birds. I enjoy looking at the old trees. I enjoy looking at the patterns in nature and the beautiful flowers. You can't just sit in the field and meditate all day. So I feel this stage at the moment is like a re-entering life and very much a celebration of life. And I've enjoyed it. And I really like the Spanish people and the Spanish culture. And you have to go with the flow, man. I'm sounding like a hippie. But I'm really starting to realise that all the little worries we have, a lot of them we create ourselves by just not accepting, hey, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. But I'm nearly there, and I am looking forward to it, and it has been an amazing experience.
And we're back, and we are talking with Sue Kenny. And Sue, I have to ask, I noticed from reading your website that you are the author of two books, and you have a documentary, Las Peregrinas, or something like that.
Yes.
You have all sorts of things going on. How does this storytelling ability relate to the purpose that you found on El Camino?
What I discovered actually is that my purpose in life is to tell stories, to use my voice to tell stories. So I am a storyteller, first and foremost. And so what I started to do was I started by just telling stories. And then, of course, as I told you, people asked me to write a book. So I wrote My Camino, and it went out to the world and became a national bestseller. Then I sold the movie rights for My Camino for a feature film to an Oscar-nominated producer in Montreal. And he agreed that that I should co-write the screenplay, that I should be a key piece in the development of the screen story. And so I spent a year and a half co-writing a screenplay. And I'd never written a screenplay in my life before. I'd never even seen a screenplay in my life before.
It's quite an adventure in and of itself.
An incredible adventure, because what I did was I took a visual experience, put it into a book, into words, then took the word experience and made it visual again, but in a different medium. And so it gave me another perspective of my Camino journey. And then from there, the film, it's in development right now. They're looking for a director in Europe, actually. So it'll be a few more years, but it should be a feature film, I would think. And then I wrote Confessions of a Pilgrim, which is a story about the journey I took on the Portuguese Camino just before I left. A native friend of mine contacted me and said she'd had a dream about me, and she had to see me before I left. When we met, she gave me a sacred eagle feather that was given to her by a native chief in Alberta. And in the dream, she was told that I was to take the eagle feather with me and give it to somebody on my Camino journey. And so I knew before I left on that journey that I would be writing a book. It was just too interesting of a story not to write about. And then I took a group of women, five women, and I took a professional cameraman, and we filmed a feature-length documentary about their individual journeys as well as the group journey. Because women kept saying to me, I'm afraid to go on the Camino, I'm afraid to walk alone. And I said to them, you know, I'd say, you can go, you can do it. But still, they were afraid. So I thought if I did a film and brought it back to people, I could show them the Camino, and then they wouldn't be afraid to either walk it in Spain or afraid to walk their own journey back here at home, whatever that might be. And the Camino, I just keep telling stories. I'm creating new things all the time.
How many times have you actually done the Camino trip?
I've walked five different times and different journeys, different lengths of time. And I'll be going again in May. I'm taking another small group with me, and we'll walk for 10 days. And then before we leave, I coach them, and we have conference calls, and I prepare them physically, mentally, spiritually for the journey. And then we also get together after we come back, and so that I can help them to integrate their journey back into their life at home.
And if more people are looking for information on your journey or your experiences, your books, or even the DVDs, where's the best place they can find it?
My website is probably the best place. So that's Sue Kenney, KENNEY.ca. And again, if anybody has any questions or, you know, they want to talk to me about it, I'm happy to answer any emails, so they can reach me on my website there, and feel free to contact me.
Well, that's good, because from what I can tell, the phones have been ringing off the hook, and unfortunately we don't have the technological capabilities to handle multiple on-air through the phone system.
But, oh, you're kidding.
So I'm sure that you'll probably have a lot of emails after this.
Oh, well, that's great. I'd love to hear from people.
Fantastic. And speaking of websites, Maha, you have become quite an internet sensation, I've heard.
Yeah, I mean, if you ignore the fact that I have videos of my cats dancing online, I have some pretty good ones as well. I have actually two websites. I actually have three, but the ones that get the most hits, I have a YouTube account where, like you said, you turn your words into videos. I've been doing the same as well. And actually this year I was lucky enough to enter the Breastfest Film Festival.
Yeah.
And unfortunately I didn't win, but I did get a lot of nominations, so that's
good.
Really great. But it's youtube.com/lifelessonswithmaha. I'm not sure what kind of life lessons people will get out of all of them. And I also have a blog, and it's Life Lessons with Maha. That's M-A-H-A .blogspot.com. And now, Sue, I have a question for you, and just be very brief with it, because I'm really, really interested to see how this turns out. Did you find, as I'm writing, I find that I do have to censor myself at times, because you go through a lot of emotions, and now your journey was extremely emotional and mentally demanding. Did you find that you had to censor yourself when you wrote your books?
Well, are you talking about writing a blog versus writing a book?
Everything, just okay. Everything that you put down, because your kids read it, your friends
yeah.
read it. Did you
well,
find that you had to censor yourself?
I did. I thought I did. I thought I would have to. But what I discovered is that if I write the truth,
mm-hmm.
Then I don't have to censor it. It's when I move away from the truth, I try to hide something, or I try to act in some way that's not natural, then I have to start censoring. The other thing is when you're writing a book, I would never ever show anybody my first draft. you wouldn't want to read it. But after several drafts, then I brought an editor on board, and with an editor can give you a more a better perspective, a more objective perspective of what's going on. And so I wouldn't, I always use an editor because I some of the stories are so emotional. Mm-hmm. And I can remember my editor saying, Sue, this is a really great story, but it doesn't do anything for the book.
So you also had a compassionate editor. Unlike our missing producer, Carrie, who she's on loan to CBC right now, and she is the most brutal editor that you will ever meet in your life. It's like, nope, you said that, doesn't relevant, cut.
She's a gift.
Oh, we couldn't live without her around here, but we've got Adam that's filling in right now. He's our assistant producer. And
he's doing a great job.
Doing a great job, considering this is the second show that he's produced for us. That's awesome. Unfortunately, we could talk about this for hours, but we're out of time. And I just want to personally thank you for coming on the show and talking with us. Thank you, Maha. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, Sue.
Yes, and thank you, everybody. And thank you for being a part of my life journey and allowing me to live what I believe is my purpose in life by sharing the story. So you're all a part of that.
Wonderful, and all of the best with everything that you're working on.
Yeah, you too. It was nice to meet everybody and hear the story.
You've been listening to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. Special thanks to our producer Adam Prince and our guests Sue Kenny and Maha El-Sabawi. Tune in February 1st for our next show, where we speak with Paralympic swimmer Darla Sayles. For a show schedule and archive of our shows, please check out www.betweenthemargins.ca. This has been Michelle Boyce and Gio Lakey. Thanks for listening.